So I think, the horror stories are plentiful, far more than the good stories right now, because companies have been allowed to.
Right.
They've been allowed to seek the boundaries. So the regulation, or I think this growing pressure from all sources on ethical, on morality in the use of this, will gradually change behavior. But it won't as long as the market rewards bad behavior.
Welcome back to The AI Element, a show about what AI can actually do. I'm your host, Alex Shi. This week, we're looking at privacy. Individuals have little control over their data, how it's collected, who collects it, and for what it is used. It's no secret that modern AI runs on data, lots of it for now, though it's an area of focus in AI research to see how we can use less of it over time. For many, the common experience with online platforms, mobile apps, and other digital services is blindly accepting whatever demands they make of our data, which are often a necessary condition for using them. Yet a new public awareness has grown amid news of scandals around the misuse of data and major data breaches, and it's clear that the private sector is getting a failing grade from consumers, and it increasingly seems from governments investigating their practices. The rise of these digital services and the handful of companies that provide them means that data is also becoming increasingly concentrated in the hands of a few private corporations. Some regulation is struck back, like the General Data Protection Regulation, or GDPR, in Europe. But we're still in the early days of clearly understanding the technical challenges in fixing these problems and who needs protecting. The GDPR and other similar regulations have been met with criticism on both sides. One saying it has been too blunt and would hurt innovation, others saying it hasn't gone far enough in protecting rights. This episode unpacks just how important it is to maintain the right to privacy, why we need more inclusive representation in determining how our data is governed, and a novel concept of data trusts as a tool for helping us navigate what is right. For this episode, we had Marc-Étienne Ouimet, our head of public policy at Element AI, conduct the interviews. Mark and his team have been working hard with organizations around the world to develop policies for more responsible approaches to rolling out AI that respects citizens and empowers them in their everyday lives. The first guest is Ed Santow, Australia's Human Rights Commissioner, who's been very influential in the AI space at connecting AI issues like privacy to the larger concern of human rights.
I think people have been very aware now for some time that the right to privacy is a particularly important right when we're talking about artificial intelligence. And that's because it's our personal information that is the fuel that drives AI. People are starting to realize that their personal information can be used against them. And that is hugely worrying, because what that means is it can be that we are discriminated against on the basis of something that we can't control. That could be our race or our age or our sexual orientation. And if that takes place, that's really fundamental. It goes much deeper than the extent to which, you know, we want to live a public life or a more secluded life. It goes to your very core of your identity. And so it's vitally important that we're able to protect people's equality. And then when you apply that in specific contexts, it can also engage a range of other rights as well, like equality before the law, right to a fair trial, all those things that we as lawyers hold dear. So a really important example of how an algorithm can go wrong came specifically from Australia, is the way in which it's sometimes being used by police. So in the state that I'm from in Australia, New South Wales, the police have a list of people that they target for very close attention. And these are all young people. So these are generally people between the ages of 12 and 25. Before I took on this role, when I was a humble human rights lawyer, my colleagues and I noticed that almost all of our clients who are on this list is known as the Suspect Target Management Plan, almost all of our clients were either Aboriginal or from a Muslim or Middle Eastern background. So we dug a little deeper. About a year ago, what came out in the media was that it was an algorithm determining who was on that list. And you could be on that list for, you know, having committed very, very minor crimes. We had a client who was 10 years old on that list, right? So we're talking about people who may have done nothing more than ridden on the train without a valid ticket. And what became clear was A, that an algorithm was determining who was on that list, and B, that 56% of the people on that list were Aboriginal.
Wow, which is far from representative of Australian society.
Exactly. So less than 3% of the population in New South Wales, my state, is Indigenous.
Right.
So it's many, many times more. And we know that if they were relying on the kind of old criminal justice data set, which is tends to be what is relied on, that Aboriginal people have historically suffered injustice at a far greater rate than the rest of the population. They're much more likely to have been convicted of essentially crimes of poverty,
right,
and been over-policed vis-a-vis the rest of the population, sometimes convicted by juries that were all Caucasian. And those were all factors that caused real problems and continue to cause problems for Aboriginal people in the criminal justice system. Now, I recognise that the police have a very important role to play and to protect the community. But if you are targeting a particular section of the community that has historically suffered injustice, that has historically not always had a good relationship with the police, then you're going to risk exacerbating a whole bunch of problems that we've been trying so hard as a community to improve. We need to understand that protecting human rights is largely about applying the laws and the rules that we've already agreed to.
Yeah.
It's not about largely dreaming up new rules. It's about saying, we've already agreed that we're not going to discriminate against people.
Yeah.
We've already agreed that if there's a decision about you, that you need to understand the basis for that decision. You don't need to understand every single micro element of the decision, but you need to understand the core aspects to it. The second thing I would say is that we need to fully understand what other human rights are at play beyond privacy. Some of the problems with only looking at this through a privacy lens is that we then start relying more heavily than is reasonable on concepts like consent. And at some point, that collapses under its own weight. The idea that you should be put in a position where you're consenting to someone using your personal information to discriminate against you on the basis of your race, well, that's not just meaningless, it's offensive.
Yeah.
And so we need to be really clear about what those human rights are engaged and then tailor our solutions so that it matches the rights that are engaged. So the first issue is whether personal information really can be exploited at all using AI. And I'm not doctrinaire about that. I do think that there are really good use cases for people's personal information, particularly in an aggregated form, to be used to improve our understanding of a range of phenomena. The critical question is whether the consent is real, whether it is, in other words, informed and people are able to exercise some level of autonomy. If you don't really know what you're consenting to, then it's not informed. And the most recent statistics from Australia suggest that 94% of people don't regularly read the privacy statements that they are quote-unquote consenting to.
My favorite stat on that front is that if every person had to read through the terms and conditions of every website and application that they use in any given year, that would take 12 weeks of full-time work. The level to which we are putting weight on the shoulders of consent to underpin how we are moving forward on these things, understanding that reality and obviously understanding that no one is, I don't think a single person on earth, frankly, is spending 12 weeks at a time reading terms and conditions is just totally unrealistic.
It's a brutal statistic.
Yeah.
And it also begs the question, who are the 6% that are regularly reading their privacy statements?
Right.
Because part of me wants to meet those people and then part of me thinks, I'm not sure how much fun they will be in kind of conversation.
And I'm pretty sure they're going to be lawyers.
But there's a second component to it. Even if you do read all of those privacy statements, what do you actually do with that information?
Most
of the time, you can't actually have a meaningful conversation with the the company that you're wanting to interact with and say, you know what, 95% of what you've said is absolutely fine, but I've got a few concerns here. So they're take it or leave it contracts. And that is convenient for the organization. And in some ways it's convenient for the individual because you just get past that privacy issue very quickly. So that efficiency is kind of dialed up to 10 or even 11.
Yeah.
But the actual protection for people's privacy isn't there.
So getting consent is important, but the conversation can't end there. You may originally consent to have your data gathered by a company, but do you fully understand what uses of your data you are consenting to? And should some of those uses be allowed, even with consent? Ed is not necessarily anti-algorithm when it comes to decision-making. In our last episode on explainability, we discussed controversial algorithmic models for determining the risk of a criminal defendant committing more crimes, and whether or not they should be granted bail or parole. While the notion of having an algorithm determine your freedom is scary, Ed reminds us of the alternative we face in human decision-making.
I feel really strongly about this because I'm a technology enthusiast.
Yeah.
I want to be really clear. I'm not starry-eyed about how humans make decisions. I'm acutely conscious of how humans can make decisions that are not rational, but that may be even prejudiced.
Yeah.
And perhaps I can give one emblematic example
sure.
of that. It's known as the Israeli parole study. And it was done in Israel, but it applies really similar circumstances in Canada, the United States, Australia, and many, many other countries in a very similar way. And so the researchers were trying to answer what seems like a really simple question. So when someone has served their entire prison sentence for committing a crime, they can apply for parole. They can apply to be released. And so the question that they were trying to ask the researchers was, what's the biggest factor that a parole judge will take into account in determining whether someone can be released at the first opportunity? And so people, lawyers like me, always assumed it might be something like, well, how serious was the offence that they originally committed?
Mm-hmm.
Or how well did they behave in prison? Sadly, these human judges did not approach it that way. So what you need to understand is how those judges made the decision. So they would hear a bunch of applications each day, and they'd hear them one by one. They'd start at about 9 in the morning and they'd finish at about 5 in the afternoon. And if you were the very first on that list, you had roughly 63% chance of being released. If you were the last person before lunch to have your application heard, it was less than 1%. If you were the first person after lunch, it bumped back up close to 63% again. And if you were the last one in the day, it was again very close to zero.
Yeah.
So computers don't get hangry, right? We know that there are some aspects of decision making that AI can do that is better than what we can do as humans. So what we need to do is we need to integrate more effectively the things that AI is able to really help us with as decision makers with the things that are quintessentially human, that we as humans can do really, really effectively.
Yeah.
And that's the big challenge. And if we don't address the threats, then we can't get the benefits.
So far, the conversation about data management has largely been about citizens, corporations, and governments. But a significant group that has been largely overlooked are people as workers. Mark sat down with Christina Coclo, Director of the Future of Work at Uni Global Union, to get a better understanding of workers' data rights across the world.
So Uni Global Union is a global union federation for all of the workers in the private services. So from banking, insurance, commerce, private security, and so on. So we represent about 20 million people, over 600 unions across the world. And for Uni, I'm responsible for all of our work on the future world of work. So how is AI, data, big data, changing what we do, how we do it, the business models that we are employed in or work through? So all of this I'm doing a lot of thought patterns on and seeing where are there some gaps, where are there some things that are not being discussed sufficiently, especially the workers' voice seems to be neglected in many circles. The gaps we see in relation to workers' needs and demands are not just twofold, probably threefold. I mean, firstly, if you just look back in history a bit, you would always at events or in government events, public discourse, include in the discussions the businesses, the consumers, and the workers. But something has shifted. Now it's as if the consumers are invited, the businesses are, but very often the workers are not. And this is something where it's very strange happening, as if the consumer organizations can speak on behalf of the workers. So that's one side. And then on the other side, if you look at the public or the government policies that are coming out all over the world on data protection, for example, they are all related to you as an individual, you as a citizen, but they're not related to you as a worker or you as a collective as a worker. And this is a huge gap. Even the European GDPR fails us on that point. We're only now beginning to see some lawsuits, so we'll test the validity of the GDPR. What is the extent of it? That said, I have seen now 4 multinational companies' data policies, and that, for me, has been really scary reading. You know, they reserve the right to log all sorts of information on not just their employees, but the extended workforce, so also subcontractors, temporary staff that comes in, and so forth. And they want to log gender, sexuality, of course, address, name, email, but also in all 4 cases, the particular clause, trade union member. You know, and this is, you know, you're reading this and go, why? I mean, this is certainly not, you know, proportionality. And there seems to be this lust for, oh, data will give us a competitive advantage. So they think the more, the richer. Without knowing that data in itself doesn't mean a lot, you have to structure it and so on. So there is almost a pornographization of data lust around the world. And I think this is something that we're working with all sorts of stakeholders on in trying to improve, you know, asking the question, what is good data stewardship? So I think, you know, as a collective, how can unions, the shop stewards, the workers work with the companies on, you know, their data governance, how they're using the data, where are they getting it from? You know, what is in the whole data life cycle, so to speak, from the onboarding of data, what data, where they're getting it from, to how they're profiling people. This is where the principle of proportionality comes into it. Who has access to the data they store? Where do they store it? Under what legislation is it stored? Who has access to that data? And then, of course, also in the end, if they delete the data or they sell it, who do they sell it to? But I think the more decisive way, the more, you know, if a government wanted to send a signal that, hey, we want to do this, we want to take the benefits of all of these new and emerging technologies, we want to do so responsibly. And we want to do so so it benefits people and planet before anything else.
There are a lot of areas for companies to rethink their approach to data collection and be more considerate of its impacts. And another story from Christina illustrates just how far some have to go.
But another example is a company in Holland who gave all of their workers a Fitbit. And, you know, they wanted to be the healthiest company around. And this reminds me of my own, you know, organization 10 years ago. We all got those ones that counted our steps, right? This was before it was all digital. So this happened, and it was pretty fine, until after about a month, one of the employees, let's call him Frank, was called into the manager's office and was told the following, like, Frank, we've noticed you don't really move after work, and you are a little bit obese, so be careful you don't become a liability to the company. Now, this, of course, is a total infringement on privacy rights. I mean, Frank can do what he wants after work, right? But this is, you know, it's an image of how all of this data, you know, they were tracking him on the GPS and could see that Frank probably, when he came home from work, turned on the television and sat there, right?
Right.
Frank can do that if he wants to.
Yeah.
But suddenly, you know, when we collect data from many different sources and it becomes this whole balance between me as a worker and me as a private person becomes totally intertwined. So I think, you know, the horror stories are plentiful, far more than the good stories right now, because companies have been allowed to.
Right.
They've been allowed to seek the boundaries. So the regulation, or I think this growing pressure from all sources on ethical, on morality in the use of this, will gradually change behavior. But it won't as long as the market rewards bad behavior. But also, and this is something we haven't discussed yet, Mark, but I know we love doing that, is this whole question about who has access to the data. One of the key problems right now is a very low public awareness to all of these issues.
Yeah.
Things are happening. And within uni, we're seeing now several really good examples and quite interesting. For example, and who really would have thought that, but in uni property services, so that's got to do with cleaners, in Holland, the company has engaged with the unions on what duties of care do they have to fulfill when introducing new technologies. So you can just imagine big industrial cleaners, robots are coming in, they are controlled by a certain amount of AI. And here the unions have negotiated with the company about what should happen with the data that's being collected, what should happen with workers if they get displaced and so forth. So this is a really good example. I think it's really important for companies, again, in the whole fight for sustainable solutions, good solutions, that they actually engage with the unions and enter into discussion about how we best can do this so all needs are catered for.
There are benefits to aggregated data, but so many murky issues of control. It's hard to not feel powerless to change this problem of data management. How can we give leverage to citizens and workers so they can negotiate for their rights and value? Mark explained to me a tool called the Data Trust his team has been researching.
You don't have a ton of control over how your personal information is being used. Yes, you click through, you know, terms and conditions that ask you whether you agree with these. They're 138 pages long. They're in legalese. And if you disagree with section 37C, there's nothing you can do other than just not accept and not use the service, right? That could be fine if you had, you know, ample choices with different privacy settings, but that's not currently the case. And so we were looking for, you know, policy tools that could be used or developed to try to address that fundamental issue. So to be able to re-empower people to have greater control over how their personal information is being used, but without throwing out the baby with the bathwater. So without kind of losing all of the innovations and all of the technology development that we've been seeing, and of course that Element AI is pushing itself. So Data Trusts uses the concept of fiduciary law, which is a big thing and a big word. What basically is structured in the same way that any other trust or a land trust or when you say a trust fund baby, right? Yeah. That you give an asset to a third party that manages that asset under the conditions that were dictated at the start for a set of beneficiaries, right? So we want to basically use that structure to govern the use of personal information. So the idea being that you would select a trust, and that trust would be managed by a trustee. That trust would have a greater reflection of what your interests are with regards to your privacy and how your personal information can be used. So that includes, obviously, levels of privacy and what you're willing to exchange for greater services or for efficiency's sake, but also who you're willing or whom you're willing to share your personal information with. So if that information, you don't really have a problem if it goes to a union or if it goes to an environmental cause or whatever the reasons are, then you could have those settings in place. And then the trustee manages your personal information on your behalf with third parties who need to access it, whether it's through, you know, an online store or a store of the future that you walk into, or it's a platform or whatever else. And the fundamental idea there is that if we pool enough people into each of those trusts have far greater bargaining power and can end up negotiating that Section 37C that I said before that you're not going to be able to negotiate. So that's the fundamental concept that we're working on.
Who came up with this idea?
Well, I mean, it's disputable, but I would attribute it to Neil Lawrence personally. And so he was the first one that certainly that I saw, but there was also Lillian Edwards, who's a professor in the UK, who'd done some research on fiduciary law and data and talked about data trusts at the same time. One of the issues that we have with data trusts now is that it is multivocal. So it means different things to different people, right? So saying who coined it first can be problematic depending on your definition of data trusts. Neil wrote an article for The Guardian a few years ago talking about data trusts and basically data feudalism. Mm. It was an extremely interesting article with historical parallels with feudalism and basically the idea that your feudal relationship is kind of the situation that you have now with your data, right? Mm. In the GDPR, you're called data subjects. Mm. He's like, that's an extremely appropriate term. In fact, you know, we're subjects to the great data barons.
So I'm Neil Lawrence. I'm a professor of machine learning at the University of Sheffield. So I think different types of data need to be handled in different ways. There's not a one-size-fits-all solution.
Right.
So the idea of data trust is almost a mechanism for creating solutions which bring this democratic accountability and allow different groups to trial sort of different approaches that are applicable to different data types. And the hope is that ecosystem of data trusts would provide the inspiration for, you know, in the longer term, what our rights should be around data and how we think about data. So data provides this control over us. And one of, I think, people's big fears is, you know, data leakages allow people to acquire our identity and damage our lives. I mean, it's difficult. There are systems for trying to secure your personal data locally, but that sort of management of security is often best handled by a larger entity. You hope, but of course it turned out in practice that they weren't really manning the barricades. And yeah, they're not a solution. They're a canvas and a set of paints.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, go paint the picture you want, you know, and we don't know which will be the picture people like. But it's a set of tools to construct a world that will hopefully be appropriate. And of course, it's not the only way this should be done. I mean, I think as you brought up, you can do something similar with a regular limited not-for-profit. And in some cases, that might be more appropriate. The fiduciary responsibility, though, is to really bring in this notion of what it leads to is this notion of a data trustee.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think the long-term hope is this role of the data trustee who's managing the data on behalf of the data subjects, not as a feudal lord, but as someone whose responsibilities are towards the people, starts to become something more akin to the type of professions we have today, like medical doctors or lawyers who we trust with that type of relationship. We trust with our data, with things we wouldn't tell our friends. And they have professional obligations to us.
What might data trusts look like in action? Neil and Mark shared an example of mental health and Facebook data.
Let's imagine the two of us were worried about mental health problems. That's a very, very common example.
Yeah.
We might want to be in a data trust that would stipulate that Facebook made our data available to some kind of medical third party that was supporting us in dealing with our mental health issues.
Yeah.
Now, or we may not. Mm-hmm. I mean, but, you know, and I think mental health is a particularly interesting one because certainly I've worked in networks where we were looking at mental health. We had patient representatives, one of whom, and I'm sure this isn't universally true, was bipolar and mentioned how anything that helps them self-monitor their condition was very important for them in managing their highs and lows. So if they could be aware that they were entering the sort of more active state of a bipolar disorder, my understanding is it's very common for the depressive state to be much worse if the active state was higher. So bipolar individuals, I'm certainly not an expert, but my understanding is can go into this very productive, very sort of manic state, but then it falls off into a sort of depression. Now, if they could, he was of the opinion that if he knew when he was entering that state, he could self-manage himself to prevent himself going too far into that, and then his depression would be less. So he might want to make various choices about who could have access to his Facebook data. You could imagine a data trust that was set up for bipolar patients like him, was negotiating on his behalf with Facebook and managing according to the best understanding how that data should be shared with a body of clinicians and perhaps with other data in order to support him in his outcomes. But you could just as well imagine someone with a mental disorder that made them paranoid about people following them or didn't want that sort of thing at all. So,
or just, you know, someone who is not affected by bipolar disease who would say, I don't want my information shared.
I don't want my information shared. And it's sort of interesting. I mean, we all, many of us would have received GDPR type confirmations around modifications of terms and conditions for compliance. And, you know, we received, I don't know, however many emails across a period of days saying, if you don't reply to this, we'll have to delete or whatever. And I think probably like many others, I just kind of ignored most of this stuff in my inbox. Now, the notion of the data trust would be that in these cases, the trust would be stipulating the conditions, which are likely to be stronger than the conditions in the GDPR because they're likely to express some particular desire, like Sylvie Delacroix was giving good examples of there might be a trust that is prepared to share data more for the common good. So by sharing data, we can help not just people with any condition I have, but maybe other conditions. So I might want to donate my data for health considerations, or other people might just want to exploit their data and have everything cheaper as a result of that. But you could have a choice of the trust, and the trust would negotiate that on your behalf, and it would be worth the while of the social media platform in discussing with the trust because, you know, if we get in the right state, there would be a large number of members. Of course, if there's one trust for everyone, which is where we are at the moment, this doesn't really work. And that's one of the challenges, is how do we get there from where we are today? Redressing the asymmetry is driven by having a shared consent. So a collective, the power that comes with data is accumulated. So by collective consent, that this needs to be taken into account, and that rebalances the asymmetry.
So Mark, what's next for data trusts?
But there's still a ton of research to be done. That's what I say. I'm so excited about what we can do at Element AI around this to try to figure out what the type of data trust that we're talking about could actually look like and how it could work in practice. We are rolling out some pilots now, empowering those consumers / citizens to have a say in how their personal information is being used. So those are actual like technical components of ultimately a reflection of the data trust concept that we're talking about. Do I 100% guarantee that data trusts will be the solution? No, I don't know. But frankly, I haven't seen anything else thus far that is as fleshed out of a possible tool. And it's not a panacea, it can't do everything, but that can start to help us address some of these fundamental issues. So that's why we decided to launch, you know, a field of research in this and to have a bunch of research projects on data trust, because it's what we believe to be at this point the most promising policy tool and ultimately a technology tool as well to address some of those fundamental issues.
Establishing a meaningful ability to negotiate the collection and use of our data as consumers, employees, and citizens would be an ongoing challenge. But it's a challenge worthy of our attention. AI systems need data to function, but if they can't use data in a way that respects human rights, then these systems won't be able to deliver on their promised benefits, especially for individuals who have already been victims of discrimination and harmful bias. Data trusts offer a promising model for enabling nuanced cooperation between data generators and data users. As Christina, our guest from Uni Global Union, said, we need to make sure that everyone is at the table in these discussions. To follow the development and use of data trusts, or dive deeper into the topics of privacy and human rights in AI, click the links in the show notes or go to elementai.com/podcast. Have a question we didn't cover? Tweet at us at element_AI and use the hashtag #TheAIElement, and we'll cover it in an upcoming episode. Thank you to our guests, Ed Santo, Christina Coclo, and Neil Lawrence, and to Makit Senwime for running the interviews. The AI Element is produced by Simon Hudson, Steph Colburn, Amanda DeRupo, and Ali Sihwa. Our booker is Claudia Roderi. Show notes and site content by Peter Henderson. Visual design by Weiwei Lin. Shout out to our digital and promotion team, Kayla, Vince, Benoit, Jen, Robin, Caro, and Kevin. Thank you to Anne, Christophe, and Vierre for making this happen.